ASICS is actually an acronym for a Latin phrase that loosely translated means of sound mind, of sound body. I was like, there it is. That's why I'm here as a CEO. I have to bring that to the forefront because that should be the mantra.
Welcome to Fit Food Junkies, addicted to health. My name is Emily E., and I'm a certified group fitness instructor and personal trainer. We will not only talk about fitness and nutrition, but also explore how to build a strong mindset, have ultimate motivation, and how to live life to its fullest. Let's start on our health and fitness journey together. Welcome back to Fit Food Junkies. I just got back from a run, and of course, I am wearing my ASICS. I happen to be interviewing the former president and CEO of ASICS America, Gene McCarthy. We all know ASICS, the holy grail of performance running, a multinational corporation producing sports equipment designed for a wide range of sports, but primarily running. Over the course of his 40 plus years in his extensive career, Gene McCarthy has held executive level positions with top brands including ASICS, Under Armour, Nike, Reebok, Timberland, and Merrell. Gene was a track and field Division I All-American. He was also a 1980 U.S. Olympic trials semi-finalist. In 1979, he penned a story for the New York Times titled Chasing the 4-Minute Mile Along the Streets of the Bronx. He currently is the founder and principal of Top League Advisory, which focuses on brand vision and strategy. Do you want to learn how to develop the skills and strong mindset in order to become a CEO? Today, I am so excited to discuss the steps to become a CEO as Gene takes us on his journey leading ASICS. We will discover how to face discomfort and fail often and early and learn about the most insightful tips for starting a brand. Gene is my biggest mentor and has such incredible sage advice to share with us today. I present to you the one and only Gene McCarthy. Gene, what a true privilege to have you on today. I'd love to hear, how does one become a CEO? What was your journey like to get to where you were as the leader of ASICS?
Wow. I mean, that could be a long answer. And I'm known for wordiness, but I'll try to give it to you in a more succinct way. First of all, I don't think anybody wakes up one day and says, I'd like to be a CEO. I think it's something that you stumble across, or you know, it's something that companies may stumble across people and find those qualities that they're looking for. But I will tell you this, when I was young, 13 years old, growing up in New York City, living in the Bronx, actually, the oldest of five kids, we lived in a 2-bedroom apartment, which meant three boys slept in one bedroom, two girls in the other, and the parents in the living room. And we had a dining room table that held four comfortably. So for seven people, you get the idea. And we all dreamed. And I think dreaming is really important for anybody, whether no matter how much of your education is out there. If you go to USC, if you go to business school, if you do anything, I still think dreaming is a formula that is personal to each of us and you have to have. And I stumbled across a magazine that was called Sports Illustrated. And there were two guys on the cover of the magazine running. And I was struck by their sinewy muscles and the grimacing on their faces and just this intensity. I read the article and I announced to my family that night at dinner, when I can get a word in edgewise, I said, guess what, everybody? I'm going to break the 4-minute mile. I was just obsessed with this idea about this athletic achievement. And even though at the time I was and still am 5'7" and 135 pounds. So as daunting as it might seem to some people, my dream never let that become a barrier for me. But the reason I mentioned that article is because I got an interest in running. It helped me get a college education. I never could have afforded to go to college. My family could never have afforded that. I got a scholarship because of my running. And then 8 years after I saw that cover, when I graduated from Fordham, I actually wrote a letter to one of the guys on the cover of Sports Illustrated because I didn't get my under 4 minutes. And he invited me to Florida. He said, I'll help you with your dream. And I moved to Florida. It's the only other place I lived outside of New York at the age of 21. And at the time, and you know, several years later, I did run the 1500 meters, which is the metric mile in the equivalent of a 359 mile. So I achieved my goal, but that's not even the point of it. To this day, after 40 years of being in the athletic industry and having worked for some of these famous brands and having been a president or a co-president or a president CEO, some of the titles I've had, it still goes back to that time in Florida, because when I moved there, I didn't learn about running faster or workouts or diets or lifting weights. I learned from the neck up. I learned the mental integrities that you had to have, the disciplines you had to have, the focus you had to have. And those things served me for my 40 years. But the other thing I will say for anybody out there who thinks, you know, you go to CEO school, and the next thing you know, you graduate, you become a CEO. Doesn't work that way. Probably my greatest gift was I've done many, many jobs in my career, from being a field rep, a tech rep, you know, going out and trying to sell the virtues of Nike shoes, but also listening to the virtues that would come back to Nike. I was a customer service person. I did sales. I did marketing. I did all of the jobs that fall underneath a CEO. And all of those gave me this basic, you know, collage that created, you know, my ability. And I'm humbled to say this, to be a president or a CEO.
That is such an incredible story. And you penned a story in the New York Times called Chasing the 4 Minute Mile Along the Streets of the Bronx. People read that. What would you want people to take away from the article that you wrote?
You know, it's interesting. I had just graduated from Fordham, living in New York at the time in the late 70s. I graduated in 1978. It wasn't exactly, you know, the greatest place on earth. The city was, fighting bankruptcy. As the Rolling Stones mentioned in their famous song, Shattered, there were rats on the west side, bed bugs uptown. You know, this town's in tatters. It was not a cool place to be. So every kid in New York, particularly graduating from school, aspired, you know, to get out. So when I did leave and move to Florida, a sports editor from the New York Times had approached me and he says, look, if you ever come back to visit your family, come by and see me. And I remember one hot, sweaty day, you know, walking down the streets of in Manhattan, going to visit him at the New York Times building. And it's one of those days that was so hot that your sweat sweats. And, you know, you try to walk at a pace where you're just fanning yourself enough to keep yourself cool without creating more sweat. That's how I remember the day vividly. And I remember going to sitting in his office and he says, why did you leave New York? And I said, well, you know, I have these goals, these dreams, these aspirations, but New York didn't seem like the place where there was any way to do that. I mean, there was no place to run, you know, there was nobody helping you. There was nothing. And I went to a place where, you know, I had a great environment, beautiful weather, all of these things. He says, you should write an article about that. And I did. And he called it Chasing the 4 Minute Mile Along the Streets of the Bronx. And the article basically was summarized. A week later, it got a bag of mail at the New York Times. And in the letters to the editor, they printed just two of them, which described the article. And I'll leave it this way in case anybody would like to read the article. One letter was from a guy from Connecticut who said he lived in the Bronx 25 years earlier. He was now in Connecticut. How dare I be critical of New York, be critical of the Bronx? And how dare I? Of course, he'd been gone for 25 years. The other letter was from a social worker in the South Bronx who empathized with everything I had to say. So I struck a nerve. But I think that's also, when you look at business and being a CEO and being in business, it's definitely, there's a dichotomy in any company. As much as we'd like to think there's all these synergies, there's a dichotomy. And you have to make sure that sometimes you have one foot on each, the guy in Connecticut and, so to speak, the social worker from the South Bronx. So it served me well, that article. And I wouldn't say I'm a writer, but I have been asked to write a book. So right now I'm in the process collecting a lot of notes.
You should 100% do that. I will be your number one fan there. I think the article is amazing. And I felt like I was almost a part of your run, a part of your journey. And it seems like so much of your childhood and that run and breaking that for you, it seemed like so much mindset went into that. I'm sure you have to have that, those skills and kind of that identity of a strong mindset as a CEO. How did those skills and that mindset translate to being a CEO?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And I think about it on a daily basis. And it's many years ago, obviously. I will say this. I think I just spoke at the Johnson School of Business for Cornell University, an Ivy League school, mm-hmm. and Zoom, of course. And I was trying to explain to them that a great education is important, but it's really there to polish off your characteristics that you were born with. You know, I've told my kids, for example, when your resume will get you an interview, it's your character that will get you a job. Mm-hmm. So I always go back to those days as a kid in New York, and you know, we weren't well off. I didn't know that until 20 years ago. I thought that's just life. That was life. Right. I didn't know we were poor. And I also learned some other, you know, acts of, you know, points of survival. Like, for example, in New York, you know, you have to know who friend or foe is before the subway doors close. And I think that taught me the instinct to read people. I think to prepare for a race, I would spend a lot of time visualizing. So my father would say, I'm going to drive you to your race today. And that would take maybe 30 minutes. And I would say, no, I want to take the bus and the subway. And everybody thought that was crazy, but I needed the time to visualize what was going to happen when I got to the race. So anybody who's listening to this might say, wow, that's interesting about a race. But that's also what I did as a CEO. There's a moment when I did take the ASICS job, and I was flattered, honored, and privileged, and humbled to be the president and CEO of ASICS America. And the reason is twofold. One, when I bought my first pair of track shoes in New York, they were Tiger shoes, which of course is ASICS.
Right.
And the second reason was it allowed me to make my allowed me to have my vocation and my avocation be the same thing. So I'm in New York just after I took the job, 2015, and my youngest son and I met for a cold beverage in a tavern in Manhattan. And I like to call it the second drink turns it into truth serum. And he said to me, Dad, what does a CEO like do? Like, really, like, what's a CEO? And I said, Pat, I only do four things. I look, I listen, I think, and then I decide. And while that sounds very simple, each of those are things that I learned as a kid growing up in New York. I learned to look, subway doors close, who's friend or foe. I learned to look, when is the light going to turn green so I don't have to break my stride or my cadence as I'm walking down the street. You look, you look, you look, you observe. The listening part, that's different than hearing something. Listening is essentially important. It's a skill that has to be worked on. And I fret to say that there's so many people, even today when I take my power walk on the boardwalk here in Long Beach, New York, it's amazing how many people are unaware of what's going on around them, but I do listen to everything they're saying, and it's amazing the stuff you can learn. The thinking part was important to me because I don't do it anymore, but I used to get up at 4:30 every day. Part of it was my time, my privacy, but it also allowed me to do something that I call open-eyed meditation. I just allowed whatever thoughts would, you know, just rush over me at that time. And I've always been one to jot something down. And to this day, I have scraps of paper everywhere that are organized in a way that I uniquely understand them and nobody else could, which is great. But all of that led me to, when I made a decision, it became informed, but instinctive. And so when I had to decide, some people would say, well, you got to that rather quickly. And the actual answer is no, I got to that through a long, long, long process of thinking and looking and listening and observing and absorbing. So the skills I learned as a runner, you know, to be aware, to visualize, all of that basically gave birth to my very, you know, interesting career.
That resonates with me so much. And I love how you said open-eyed meditation, because I tell that to people too, that running is my ultimate meditation. I've always been a runner. I used to run track and field, and I don't know what it is. People say, how can you love running? And I ran track and I liked it and all, but the second I didn't have a coach and I just started to run more for fun and enjoyment, and also just to get your stress out, I just realized that was my ultimate outlet. And it was different. Instead of racing someone else, it was almost just racing myself. And the other day I went on a run and getting my stress out. And I was also, you mentioned dreaming and creating a vision for yourself. And that really came into my mind. I have these things that I want in life, and you have dreams and you have goals and you're running. And I think about that as I run, and it really is an open-eyed source of meditation. And a lot of people do not realize that they just go for, oh, I'm going to burn 100 calories, or, oh, I'm going to do this. But there's so much more that goes into it to develop your strong mindset. Thank you for mentioning that, because that resonates with me so much. And I also want to touch on the point that you were talking to your son about looking, listening, thinking, and deciding. Especially this day and age, everyone's looking down on their phones. No one's really listening anymore and thinking for themselves. How can people listen more?
Yeah, you know, you bring up something important, and I loved what you had to say about, you know, how you use your runs. Yeah, there are people that run for fitness, mm-hmm. but I think there's a greater good there. And so, for example, when I was a runner, I ran as a means to an end, meaning I would get a scholarship, I would see the world, maybe get a career. I used it as a mechanism for that. And I had a hard time after my running career was over, how to use running for more of the purpose of just being. Mm-hmm. And when I joined ASICS, for example, you know, I completely aware of who they were. They were always a competitor. You know, I was at Nike, Reebok, Under Armour, all these companies. We always competed against them. What I didn't know is that ASICS is actually an acronym for a Latin phrase that loosely translated means of sound mind, of sound body. I was like, there it is. That's why I'm here as a CEO. I have to bring that to the forefront, because that should be the mantra. You could read a book, Emily, and it can stimulate you intellectually, but it's not going to stimulate, you know, your thighs or your calves. You can go take a run, and it can not only stimulate your thighs and your calves and your upper body and all that, but it could also stimulate your mind. And I, to this day, will never dissociate when I run. I do not use, you know, my AirPods. I don't take a phone. I have an iWatch just so I can see how and where and how fast. But I want to hear and feel everything around me. You ask about how people can become more aware. I think you just have to become more aware. You know, I it's fascinating to me how many times you can hold the door for somebody and they never say thank you, or how many times you're right behind somebody and they never hold the door open for you. If people are in their own little worlds. Yeah, is it about social media and all that? We can go on for that. But I also think it's if you're going to be successful, you have to be aware of everything. You have to have a peripheral vision, and you have to have a 360 vision, actually, to see what's going on around you in business, no matter what your role is. I also think that, you know, when as a CEO, I learned that the ice melts on the periphery. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the front lines of the battle, you know, and that's what business is, right? If you look at the front lines and the people who are out there in the trenches, whether it's the salespeople or the tech reps or whoever they are, they're seeing things before they ever make it back to the corporate boardroom. Because I'll tell you one thing about a corporate boardroom, I don't care what anybody says, there's no answers in any corporate boardroom in the world. There's just questions. The answers are out in the streets. So if you think about going for your run, you're not only able to find answers, like if you allow the business side of you to wash over you and flow through you, you'll sort everything out. But I also think the personal side, you have found, you know, who am I? What do I want to do? I think exercise and fitness are so important to grounding yourself, not just to give you a toned body, you know, and a good resting heart rate.
Yeah, and I talk about that in my classes too. It's the weight loss, all of that will come with it. But if you start with your mindset and the motivational aspect behind exercise, that's number one. All the extra benefits will come with it. But so much time, I think our body holds on to that stress and that weight too. And once you running or anything, you just let that go, it's going to really transform your mind and body. And like what you mentioned of the acronym of what ASIC stands for, it's very, very powerful. Very powerful. I know you've had over 30 years of experience working in sporting goods, footwear, apparel industries that we mentioned before. And one thing you also spoke about was looking at the ship in the eyes of the crew. And you were saying that you've had to work in the positions under you in order to really be able to lead your company. So can you explain what that means, looking at the ship in the eyes of the crew?
Yeah, so thank you for saying that, because it's personal to me. Like many young people, I had a tenuous relationship with my dad growing up, and he was very proud that he served in the Navy. And he said to me one time, he always had these pearls of wisdom, but one of them was, the first thing the captain should do is look at the ship through the eyes of the crew. And so any place that I've ever joined or worked, it was perplexing to the executives and the vice presidents and all the, you know, the heavy brass that reported to you, when I would spend time, you know, in the cafeteria or at the front desk with the receptionist or walk in the halls. I used to call it taking a lap. Whenever I had a break in my schedule, which wasn't often, I would take a lap and I would just walk around and talk to whomever. That's where the answers were. And I just think, you know, you have to look at the ship through the eyes of the crew. I think the idea of being a CEO isn't to have all the answers. I think the idea of a CEO is to put yourself like in a car. The car, they always say a car is like the ultimate time machine. Mm-hmm. When you're sitting in a car, you're in the present. When you look in that little rearview mirror, you're looking at the past. And by the way, the rearview mirror is smaller than the windshield where you're looking at the future. So I think that's your job as a CEO, is to be in the present, the past, use the past, not recreate the past, but definitely look at the future and how do all things inform that. I've always found that the people who run the business, I always told my teams, I always said, you don't work for me, I work for you. And I really do believe that. It sounds like modern CEO, blah, blah, blah. But the reality of it is, I would contend that if some of the more prominent CEOs who went to CEO school, where they put on the right suit and they have the right CEO language and the right CEO hairspray and all that, I think if they took maybe a page out of my book, they probably would not only find it more informing, but they might find it liberating.
Many CEOs that lead a company like that, and I think that is remarkable that you're able to do so and just have that perspective as a leader. I was talking about your years of experience. How did you move yourself up the corporate ladder? How does one do that? How can I follow in your footsteps, Gene?
Well, here's what you need to do, Emily. So keep working on your upper body strength. And then anybody who's ahead of you, beat them up in the hallway. No, I'm just kidding. Right. I'm being facetious. That's not true. However, that is a business strategy, particularly for men. That's why I've always favored having, you know, my leadership team to always be very, very diverse and particularly focus on women. And I'll tell you why. Not because it's the popular thing to do, but I heard a quote years ago where the quote was, men run for political office to make a name for themselves. Women run for political office to make a difference. So I've always balanced my teams because of that. And then also the male ego in the executive suite gets a little much. And I'll be candid enough, now that I've, you know, thoroughly done with a good portion of my career, that the male ego is basically a thin veil for insecurity. So how do you work your way up? And I think it's never forget where you came from. Always observe the people that are around you. Recognize if you're a manager, let's say you're a marketing manager for digital, let's say, and that's a really good job. if anybody should have it. Recognize that you need to surround yourself with people who could replace you tomorrow, or surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. There's sometimes back to, and this again is the male ego, their insecurity of having anybody threaten them, you know, causes them to lead some type of authoritarian, you know, dictatorship, whatever it may be. I also think look for mentors throughout an organization. Find people who are successful that you can learn from and not tell you specifically how to do things, but you observe their actions, their behavior, not just their successes and failures, but how do they behave? How do they act when they walk through the hallway? How do they engage with other people? And I think then, I've mentioned this to you, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours. Ever since I met you, you are amazingly dynamic. You have a great future and career ahead of you. You have a great career now. And, you know, it's just a matter of time before people recognize that.
That is so kind, Gene. That means so much.
A lot of your listeners, I'm sure it's the same way. The first thing you have to do when you get up in the morning is look in the mirror and make sure you know who you are, mm-hmm. what you're good at, what you're not good at, mm-hmm. and accept those things that you're not good at and be humbled by the things you are good at and try to improve them.
You said when you wake up in the morning, how do you know what you're good at, what you're not good at? I know so many people don't know what their real strengths are, what their passions are in life. How do you discover that?
I think you discover it through this scary world called failure. Mm. And I think you have to try things. When I joined ASICS as an example, one of my first speeches to the entire organization, and ASICS America is from Canada all the way down to Argentina, throw in Mexico and a few other countries, it's a big deal. And I said to everybody, please be comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think you have to do that to yourself sometimes. Sometimes you just have to throw yourself out there and trust your instincts, trust your personal compass, your internal compass, that you can always protect yourself, but take risks and fail. You know, and there's the old saying about fail, you know, often, but fail early. You know, don't fail when it's really big. Right. So, you know, it's, I think when you look in the mirror, I think what you need to decide is not who you want to be, decide who you are and how do you expand on that? Hmm. It's powerful.
Right.
It takes time. It's not like something you do and then you put on your Sonicare toothbrush and, you know, brush away. It's something that I just think when I go back to the look, listen, think, and decide, the time that I spent the most was on the thinking. And I think it's also the self-evaluation. I really do think that's important. And there's an old saying, Oscar Wilde said, you know, always be yourself because everybody else is taken.
Hmm. I love that quote so much. And it's really true what you said about listening and self-evaluation. During this time period, I was always super busy, running around like a chicken without a head. I love being busy, but it's important to take a moment and kind of escape from real life for a moment. And for me, that it really is through running. I think it's really important for people to find their outlet. Maybe it's not running, but something else. Maybe it's meditation. Maybe it's just sitting still or going on a walk with no phone, like what you do, and no technology other than a watch, of course. but really just taking that time to self-evaluate and disconnect and unplug, I think is really important to also discover those strengths and see what you're passionate and really good at. And you also talked about discovering your discomfort and facing it. Ever since I heard you speak, I always say that, mention it in my classes when I teach spin or weightlifting classes. I always say, get to the point of discomfort today and surpass that and embrace it, because that's when you're going to feel and discover the change mentally and physically inside of you. So thank you, because I truly say that in my classes because of you.
Well, I thank you for, you know, taking it and putting your quote spin on it, and which I think is important. I just think that we all think there's a formula out there, and the formula is personal to each of us. So it's like a fingerprint. We're all different for a specific reason. And you know, you have to find your inner self. And I've always felt that I've been in touch with that. And it's something I've always protected, And it's something that's personal to me. And no matter how many people, whether it's family, friends, or others, they're never going to know what that inner self-worth is to me, because that's personal and private, and it's very, you know, intimate. The next level is when you go to the emotional level. You know, what can you learn from your failures? Not how do you feel, you know, in your successes. I never celebrated a victory in a race, or, you know, hitting a good number for a quarter as a CEO. I've always was more relieved because that's what I was supposed to do, not because it was some amazing thing. Then there's something, and I've always been interested in what you focus on, is this idea of being fit. So I talk about emotionally and spiritually, but how about just physically? I did learn, particularly when you travel the world, you know, how do you access, you know, good diet, good nutrition, good health? Mm-hmm. So I remember when I was at ASICS, and the company was focused on serious runners, but the serious runners were aging. And my job was to grow the business. So I figured we have to expand this conversation to a new audience. And I thought about how best to do that. And of course, everybody signs a spokesperson or whatever. I actually have a story for another podcast with you, Emily, of sitting on Jennifer Aniston's couch in her home, just she and I, and she made me tea for 2 hours. And I'll tell you about that another time. I remember I was in London, and I asked my team or our PR agency, find somebody for me. And they found a guy named Steve Aoki. And Steve Aoki is a great, great, amazing DJ. But he's also Japanese American. I work for a Japanese brand. Right. His father founded Benihana. He was probably, the most important part, he's probably more fit and health conscious than some of the athletes we had on under contract. And I remember meeting him and being just totally caught up in health and fitness and all that. And I said to him, he would sometimes do as many as 275 shows around the world in a year, which is almost like every day. And I met him in the south of France. We flew there, and I met him, and he was having dinner before a show. And I thought it was dinner after the show. And we had this beautiful fish that was deboned. And I said, you can't eat like this all the time when you're on the road. He goes, I won't travel unless I'm allowed to eat like that. So fitness was very, very important to him, because his heart. I've
lived vicariously through your time in the south of France with Steve Aoki.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And then I thought I arrived there at like 9 o'clock, and they were having dinner, just he and four or five other people. And I thought they had the show, and I asked him how the show was, and he goes, no, the show's at 2 a.m. So shows you how old I am. I did not attend his show. But I guess my point is he embodied this idea of sound mind, sound body. What you put into it is very important. How you use your body, even when you're not, there's so many people that exercise and they try to be fit, and they do it for an hour a day, and then the other 23 hours, they erase it. I think, you know, having sound mind, sound body, being fit mentally and physically, is a lifestyle that you do all the time. Take the stairs, not the elevator. You know, drink plenty of water. Be mindful of the planet that you're on, and you know, conserve energy. Do all these. There's so many things, because it all just at the same time. The whole idea is to go to sleep at night feeling like you gave it your best, and you wake up the next day ready to give it another go.
I love that. How did you guys even think about getting him to be a part of it? And was this your brand strategy?
Well, so we had a wonderful, wonderful PR agency, and they were in New York, and I told them what I was feeling, and they said, we have a guy for you. And it turns out one of the guys in the agency actually knew him. And I'm still, you know, I still keep in touch. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. And, you know, most DJs don't live a life. He doesn't drink. He's totally fit, only eats good food. He works out. He has a playhouse in his house in Las Vegas. And I have a video of where he made me jump into a foam pit, you know, from four stories high. He would dive off his deck into his pool. So it was his life. It wasn't just he was a DJ and then led another life. I think you have to have a holistic view of who you are. And I'm not just talking about fitness. I'm talking about fitness to be an executive or a CEO, a marketing manager, an aspiring person. you know, your life in the boardroom and in the weight room are should not be different.
I love how you talk about that translation, how it should not be different. Consistency, that's just going to keep you going. Your life is truly incredible. So amazing to hear about it. And you also talked about the marketing and using Steve Aoki. I know you talk a lot about ideas versus trends versus being over, what's popular versus being cool. So if someone's looking to start their own company, how do you know if it's just an idea? Is this something I can pursue? Is this something that's going to be popular? How saturated is the market? How do you start and really be able to see where your idea or trend stands in that space?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Emily. The working title for my book is called Chasing Four, which is a take from the headline from that 1979 article, Chasing the 4-Minute Mile. And the reason I want to use Chasing Four is because I did chase the 4-Minute Mile, and that aspiration, you know, turned into a life well lived. But I also chased four as a CEO. I had to chase four quarters. Every quarter I had to hit a number for the shareholders. So, you know, chasing four quarters. I had four kids. I chased four kids around. I was the oldest of five. I had to fight off four siblings. So four is an important number to me. So I'm going to give you, if somebody's out there and they have an idea, these are the four pillars of the idea. The first one is, you know, what's in a name? So think about names like Nike. Sounds cool, right? Well, guess what? The night before Nike announced that it was called Nike, the night before it was going to be called Dimension 6. Not as sexy, right? Now, let's go to the other side of names. There's good names like Joe Montana. I mean, that name was made for an athlete. Derek Jeter, you know. But then there's Ben Roethlisberger, and his name, he had the best-selling jersey one year because you can transform unlikely names into important names. Look at Uber, Tesla, you know, Google, all these names. They're not real names, you know, but they became something. The three of the most iconic fashion brands in America are named after, you know, men that you might not name your children after: Calvin, Ralph, and Tommy. So a name is important. So you have to have a name. That's really important. The second point, the second pillar is nobody cares about your brand unless they know what your brand cares about. Hmm. So if you're just going to start a company and have a cool name, and people want to know what you stand for. And it doesn't mean, well, you know, we planted 100 trees in the rainforest. You have to stand for something. You know, what is the value system that your brand is based on? The third point is probably the most important point. What problem are you trying to solve for? So if somebody says, I want to start a shoe company and make shoes that are cool like Air Jordan, you will not succeed. If somebody said, I noticed there's a segment of the population, or there's a sport out there that isn't being attended to, or I'm trying to solve a problem. So you really need to look at it from that perspective. That gives birth to the product, not the product gives birth to the problem. The problem has to give birth to the product itself. The last one is culture. And culture is not a small point. Somebody asked me when I spoke at Columbia Business School if I ever thought that Adidas would pass Nike or beat Nike. And I said, because everybody looks at it as a competition, right? And I said, no, I'll tell you what's going to beat Nike: its own culture, its own people. And sure enough, Nike has had problems over the last several years, whether it be gender inequity, racial inequity, all kinds of different problems. Many companies have that. But that was the most plaguing problem that Nike's had over the last 10 years, not what Adidas was going to do or Under Armour. So it's, you got to have a great name. It's got to be thoughtful. What do you stand for? Mm-hmm. What problem are you trying to solve for? And what is your culture? Which, said another way, is what are your personal values if you're a founder? So when Emily starts her business, which I'm going to invest in, you're going to have your personal values are going to end up being the values of your corporate family. So I hope that's helpful to any aspiring entrepreneurs out there.
It's extremely helpful. And I mean, it's also important that after I heard you speak a couple years back, I think that you hear of ASICS and you hear, yes, of course. I mean, I know the slogan is the holy grail of performance running and you always see runners using it. But the fact that I was able to hear the CEO of ASICS just have such a strong mindset and believe so much, not only in the product itself, that's not only, you know, the tangibility of the product, but really the idea behind it and how you've built a story behind your product, I think is so powerful. And it really does resonate with consumers to see that, you know, it's not just that you have a product and okay, yeah, it's a great running shoe. It's almost like you give runners this power that they can feel as strong as possible and run as fast as possible by everything that you stand for behind the product. So I think it's also important that, you know, you can be the CEO and have every degree, as many degrees as a thermometer, but if you don't have that integrity and build a strong story behind a brand, you're not going to have your consumers believe in it.
Well, so that's a very important point about storytelling, and being Irish, storytelling is part of my heritage and part of my being. But I will say this, Emily, is that if you give somebody a resume, this is what it says. Here's who she is. Here's where she lives. Here's where she went to school. And here's how she dolled up all her information to make her job more glamorous than it really was. That's a resume. A story is, hey, I'm Jean. I was born in the Bronx, oldest of five kids. I read a newspaper or a magazine article. I aspired to be a 4-minute miler. Tell a story. Everybody has a story. And I think you have to develop your story. And I think it's not just with products. I think it's with people. I think you need to tell your own personal story. And it needs to be intimate, but it needs to be inviting. And it has to be important to the listener as well. You know, there's an old saying, if a salesman were meant to speak, she'd have two mouths and one ear. And, you know, so I think what you have to do is you have to make sure if you are going to speak that you have avid listeners. You know, you talk about storytelling. I remember Under Armour, when I joined Under Armour, they were trying to be the little, you know, it was the whole David Goliath thing with Nike, which I think ultimately became a mistake. But they had this idea that if you put on one of their t-shirts, it would empower you to be better, almost like Superman. And I thought that was a really powerful story. What happened was Wall Street loved the story, invested in the story. And then the story changed to, when are you going to beat Nike? And the consumer doesn't care about that narrative. When is Under Armour or Adidas going to beat Nike? By the way, if you do the math, it's impossible to catch up to a $40 billion company when you're $4 billion, you know, at least over the next couple of decades. And then Under Armour got caught up in a big mistake. And I think this is another point about whether it's your own personal brand or even a brand you're starting or a brand you work for. There's a difference between popular and cool. And you can't decide you're cool. The consumer decides you're cool. I remember when I was at the Jordan brand, we had a mantra. It was my mantra, which is probably more prevalent today than even back then. It was, we don't own this brand. Kids do. We just manage it for them. And when you allow that liberation of the consumer to tell you what they think your brand should be, only then can you be successful. And Under Armour, for example, got caught up in trying to buy cool rather than be cool. So popular. Every kid went to high school. There was a kid who won the science fair, right? And when she won the science fair, she was popular. But the cool kid was either the captain of the cheerleading team or the point guard on the basketball team or the quarterback. Cool is decided by your actions sometimes, not your words or the fact that you want to be cool. And I do think with people's personal brands and everybody who's listening, you know, think about yourself. Try not just to be yourself and then allow popular maybe gives way to cool.
That's a very, very interesting perspective that a lot of people don't really talk about. What's one thing that you wish you knew before you began your career?
I think while I talked a lot, Emily, that's a really good question. But when I talked a lot about self-awareness, I think there's a thing about self-importance. And I'll give you a story I read in a leadership book. And it was about Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. and he was in Springfield, Illinois, and he went into this one building, whatever, and there was a Western Union telegram guy there, and he said, you know, Mr. President, we have a telegram here, and it says that we just lost 100 horses and a brigadier general in some battle with the Confederacy. And Mr. Lincoln just said, where are we going to find another 100 horses? And the Western Union guy said to him, but what about the brigadier general? And he says, oh, we can always get one of those. So I think there's this self-importance we put on ourselves that what you do is not who you are. You know, and yes, CEOs come and go. When you're hired to be a CEO, you're hired to be fired, like a baseball manager. And sometimes you're brought in to grow the business at 5%, and other times you're brought in to change the business. But I think it's your self-importance that can get in the way. And I've seen that with a lot of CEOs, and I've stumbled across that myself. I'm not innocent from it. But I just wish I knew that, you know, the important things in life aren't just about your career. And nobody's going to remember 5 years from now what their bonus was. But you will remember when, you know, who your close relationships are, your friendships are, when your baby's born, when, you know, those are the important milestones in life. So just make sure that, you know, you separate, you know, who you are from what you do. And I wish I would have known that. Sometimes I realized that people clamored towards me because I was a CEO. And I didn't, sometimes was blind to that. I remember one time, I'll tell you this one quick story, moving to Portland, Oregon. And I was never the one to do the neighborhood, you know, social parties. And we went across the street to this house, and I was actually quite nervous. I spoke at Earth Day one year in front of 100,000 people. It doesn't faze me, but to go to a neighbor's cocktail party actually makes me quite nervous. I'm kind of an introvert, extrovert, whatever. And I went in there, and these men heard that I work for Nike, and all of them in their khakis and their plaid button downs that their wives bought them on sale at Macy's. And I'm in there in my jeans and my black t-shirt, which has been my uniform for 40 years. And they were like, so you work at Nike. Do you know so-and-so? I'd go, no. Oh, you've been there 17 years and you don't know so-and-so? No. And they were basically putting out fake names. So back to the subway doors close and open, I saw a guy kind of like giggling, and I realized I was being played. And then one guy said to me, so what do you actually do for Nike? And I said, well, I just joined the Jordan brand. Well, isn't it interesting how they all changed their tune? One guy actually gave me his card and asked me if I saw Michael, if I could give him his business card, because maybe he needs financial help, which I'm pretty sure Michael Jordan didn't need after, you know, at that time, 15 years in the NBA, financial help. So you know what I'm getting at? So my point is, you can't get caught up in your title. You know, be who you are. Stay true to your school. It'll make you a better leader, manager, CEO, et cetera.
That is amazing advice. Thank you for sharing everything with us today. I mean, your experience, your leadership is truly remarkable. Thank you for your sage advice. And you're just such an incredible person, not only CEO, but just person in general. I want to ask you my last question. At Fit Food Junkies, our motto is addicted to health. So Gene, what are you addicted to?
So addicted, does it have to be healthy?
It could be anything.
Okay. So I'm addicted to trying to understand the human condition. So that's a more broad esoteric comment. If you want something that's more tangible and more physical, I'm addicted to walking as fast as I can. I'm addicted to, no matter where I am, you know? So if I'm on an airplane and I'm in row 18, I may not be the first person off the plane, but I'll be the first person to baggage claim. So I'm addicted to that. I'm addicted to the idea of going to bed at night feeling, you know, satiated and accomplished, and waking up the next day with a clean slate. And the other thing I'm addicted to is, and it's become my passion in my semi-retirement career, I'm addicted to helping young people, you know, find their way, because nobody really helped me. So it's a passion of mine. So it's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about working with you on this podcast is because you're a future. Well, you're a star right now, but you're a big star in grooming, and I just want to feel like I'm a part of it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I can't tell you how much that means to me, and thank you for sharing your addiction. You also talked about
the human condition. I'm very interested in the human condition. I think I'm interested in what makes people tick. I'm interested in what makes them happy, what makes them sad, and I'm interested in discerning. You know, when they are happy, are they really sad? Are they sad? Are they really happy? So I'm ultra sensitive to other people. It's really important to me. However, I'm super private, and I'll leave you this one final quote. We had a CEO at Timberland when I was the co-president, and he wanted to do all this community service and all these great things. You know, Habitat for Humanity. Every employee had to work 40 hours a year community service, but he was so uncomfortable around other people that we used to say that he loved humanity. It was human beings he didn't like. So I have to try to find my balance between loving humanity and, you know, when I get out there and, you know, be amongst the masses. So anyway, but Emily, I'm proud of you. And this has been one of the pleasures of my year. And I wish you nothing but all the best.
Jean, thank you so much. Right back at you. I can't tell you how much it means to be sitting here with you. You are such a remarkable human. And ever since about 3 years ago, when I heard you speak, I just knew that we were going to stay in touch. You are my biggest mentor. Your words 3 years ago resonate with me today, and I use them to motivate others. I just want you to know how much of a powerful impact you have in the mind and body in my life. And I can't tell you how much I thank you for being with me here today.
The pleasure is all mine, my friend.
Thank you, Jean. I will see you very soon.
I look forward to it. Be well.
Wow, what an interview and what a treat to have Jean on my podcast today. I hope so much of what he said truly resonated with you. And I hope you learned different skills and ways to develop and train your mindset each and every day to become a successful leader. If you have not already, please subscribe and comment below. It would mean so much to me. Also, reach out to me at Fit Food Junkies and let me know how you like this interview today. I hope you got so much out of it. I am so excited that you are joining the Fit Food Junkies journey with me.